So I'm Rick Hansen, and it's November 26th, 2014. And I want to try to talk with you about something tonight that has become really central for me in my own practice and kind of in life altogether. And I was exploring some of it with you in the meditation. As you probably know, if you've been here before, I usually try not to say very much during the meditation. So it was unusual for me to offer those three specific suggestions from 7 o'clock on. And they speak to this thing that I'd like to talk about with you tonight, which I'll call the three refuges. Three refuges. And as you probably know, the essence of Buddhism, certainly as taught by the historical Buddha himself, boils down to what he called the third noble truth, the possibility of a mind free of the craving, broadly defined, that gives rise to suffering and harm. And the path of practice is to really rest increasingly in the mind of a Buddha. So the mind of a Buddha, by definition, is a mind that's free of craving. What in the world could be the underlying neuropsychology of that kind of mind? That's very central, isn't it? It's a central matter. And it's also a very practical one, because from the standpoint of evolution, summarized and simplified in terms of the three stages of evolution of the brain, the reptilian stage, mammalian stage, and primate human stage, craving fundamentally is grounded in an underlying sense of deficit or disturbance. Craving is a drive state. We crave because something's missing. We crave because something is disturbing. And part of the Buddha's great insight, which I think is related to our three fundamental needs. So we crave because we're in a sense of state of deficit or disturbance with regard to safety, broadly defined. We're anxious. We feel helpless. We're worried. We feel threatened. Something's about to get us. So we feel disturbed, or there's a deficit of safety. Or we have deficits or disturbances about our more mammalian needs for satisfaction, or our more primate human needs for connection. Okay. The Buddha's great insight was that a person could experience things as unpleasant and therefore as challenges to safety without tipping into craving. That's a radical breakthrough. There's no end to unpleasant, right? Even in the lives of the great saints, the great siddhas, the body has unpleasant sensations in it, and the mind has unpleasant. The loss of a loved one is unpleasant. Right? The recognition of injustice in the world is unpleasant. There is unpleasant, but the question is, what's our relationship to unpleasant? Do we relate to unpleasant from the standpoint of enoughness and balance? That's the third noble truth. Or do we relate to the unpleasant from the standpoint of a sense of deficit and disturbance? That's the second noble truth, the one of craving. The same is true for pleasant. The Buddha's radical breakthrough was that you can enjoy the pleasant without tipping into craving for it. Hopefully the pleasant you're enjoying is relatively wholesome. You know, the pleasant of, in his case, these kind of blissful meditative states, or the pleasant of good company with other people, or the ordinary pleasantness of drinking water when you're thirsty. Can we be with the pleasant in a way that has a sense of feeling already full? There's already an enoughness, and we're already balanced and stable with regard to the pleasant, rather than there being an underlying sense of neediness or deficit or being disturbed so that we've got to grab after it and chase after it. Right? Also, in terms of relationships, he didn't call this distinction out that much, but it's really implicit, I think, in what he taught. There's a sense of the relational field, things being heartfelt, not just boiling down to pleasant or unpleasant, but having some kind of magic, some sort of mystery, some sort of complexity, some sort of emergent nature that transcends a mere addition or subtraction of pleasant or unpleasant features, in the sense of something feeling, for lack of a better word, heartfelt. And here too, he was observing. We can feel love, we can feel outrage at injustice, we can feel concerned and compassionate toward the, or with regard to the suffering of others, but we can do that on the basis, again, of feeling already connected, already loved, already centered ourselves in an unconditional lovingness for other people, rather than getting sucked into envy or resentment or vengeance or ruminating about some interpersonal issue because we feel somehow we have a hole in our heart or we're troubled or disturbed in our relationships. See that distinction? It's right under our nose, isn't it? And so the practice that I've been doing more and more, and it is a kind of refuge, is to find refuge again and again and again in an authentic sense, in terms of a loose framework of those three needs, safety, satisfaction, and connection, an authentic sense of safety. An authentic sense, broadly defined, of satisfaction as well as connection. And I want to share with you some of that exploration and kind of invite you into it. So let's just take safety, for example. I find that there's certain cues and recognitions that are really useful and interesting. One is the recognition that in this moment, two things are happening, in my mind most of the time. One, there really is this awareness that this body's actually all right, right now. It may not be all right tomorrow, right? But now it's okay. It's not dying right now, right? There's enough air right now. Now is okay. And even in this now, there's not some terrible attack. Nothing is coming at me in this instant, you know? And simultaneously, there's this ongoing background trickle of anxiety. Baseless anxiety. Isn't that interesting? Look at your own experience. Your own experience, you know, and then you know, and then you know that you're actually okay. And with that as well, typically, is some kind of background uneasiness, a scanning for threat, feeling kind of rattled. So a lot of what I do is I keep trying to see through that delusion of delusional threat in this moment and see what it's like increasingly to have that kind of fall away and to feel all right right now. Different things work for different people. You know, that word safety may not work for you. You know, it may be more like, can I be with whatever's unpleasant without resisting it at all? While knowing at the same time that there's an ongoingness of all rightness. Or it might be for you that there's a sense of, and also, in other words, there is, let's say, pain, there is unpleasant. Maybe there's concern about something, you know, a health issue or financial issue. Okay. And also, there's a level in us, place of deep consciousness, kind of an ongoingness, a beingness, that's not invaded by or overtaken by whatever is difficult. And so when you rest in that, you find more and more, there's some like abiding or a growing level of peace inside. There may also be anxiety or worry, like animal worry sitting on top of it, or irritability, or, you know, your back is out and it's just bugging you and it keeps flashing red, you know, on the inner dashboard of the body. And also, there's some place inside that's just not attacked. You're at peace in that regard. See what I'm saying? Yeah. Then satisfaction. This funny phrase has just kind of there more and more for me. And it's already entirely satisfied. Now, I know that's an act of cultural disobedience in American consumer culture, but to feel already entirely satisfied. But you might play around with what that's like. What's it like to enjoy the pleasant with no sense of drivenness whatsoever to go get more? And to do that while at the same time being open to wholesome aspirations of helpfulness or exploring your own abilities, writing the book that's in you to write, singing the song that's in you to sing, you know, whatever that might be, making the soup tonight that's in you to make. But to do that, to feel lifted by that aspiration without it being based on any sense of anything missing in your life already, or missing deep down in your core, already entirely satisfied. The trick, I think, a lot, is to start, in a way, identifying these states of being, tracking these distinctions, and as we begin to get an intimation of some useful, beneficial state of being, like the two I'm calling out so far, feeling already all right, unnecessary bracing, armoring, anxiety can fall away. Right? Also, there's often a sense of strength in that. I can deal with this. I'm okay. We're okay. It's not comfortable. I don't like it. I'm okay. We're getting through it. Right? The safety thing. So you know what that starts to feel like more and more. And then also the one around satisfaction, the enoughness, like a radical enoughness. Like, wow, be nice to have more. It's okay to enjoy more. It's okay to wish for more. Nothing wrong with that. The Buddha was not against that. He didn't say, don't do that. He talked about the happiness visible in this present life and the importance of, you know, you got a garden, pull the weeds, water it. Put some fertilizer on it. You know, wish for it to bring much fruit. It's fine. But without feeling at all disturbed about that, what's that feel like? So as we try to identify these states of being that are, they feel so true and so sweet and right in terms of the longings of our heart, as we identify these, we try to know what they feel like so we can stabilize them. Ah, like this. I can kind of settle increasingly in this place of, for example, feeling that you're already entirely satisfied. And then with relationships last, again, this funny phrase, and I think what I've learned about this is that different things will zap different people in good ways. So find your zap, right? Whatever zaps you into the, you know, the moving into the third noble truth or the deepening of that or the beginning to string together more and more seconds of arresting with a completely full heart and an undisturbed mind. Right? So around the connection issues and so forth, two things have really kind of are pathways for me into that. One is to have a felt sense of my own good heart. So for you, a felt sense of your own good heart, good intention. It's imperfectly expressed. You know, John Wellwood has this great line, perfect love, imperfect relationships, right? But even if the expression of the good heart is imperfect, the goodness of the heart is not. And just kind of knowing, you know, like, for example, right now I'm in a situation in my extended family network where someone in my system, I'll kind of protect the innocent, is, I think, really angry with me. And I have no idea really why, because it's entirely cut off. And it's a very peculiar situation, you can imagine, when you're in those situations. Mm-hmm. So for me, practice is a lot about looking at and taking responsibility for, what could I have done, even without shaming oneself, just what could I have done, or what could have been the causes rippling out from this locus of causality over here in this larger, vast net of causal tugging and pushing and so forth, strands. And setting aside from that, just to looking like, wow, what was really true? And I know in my heart with regard to this person in my world that I've had overwhelmingly good intentions. It's a long relationship. Overwhelmingly caring, serving, protecting, championing, supporting thing. I know I've had a good heart there. And so when you know that in yourself, or you can, or at least maybe you haven't had such a great heart, but at least right now you know I'm finding my way again, including copping to whatever there might be to cop to. But it's funny, when we come to kind of like, oh, I can take refuge in the feeling of and the knowing of my own goodwill or willingness to try or be a good person and so forth, that settles something inside. It's not the only thing. I'm just talking about find your zapper. What zaps you? The other one, I actually had this insight sitting in this room about, I don't know, 3 or 6 months ago. It just came to me, feeling loved enough. While knowing that it's okay to want to be loved more, like to wish for other people, you know? I would wish for you that even more people loved you and liked you and even liked you in super special ways, right? That would float your boat in a wholesome sense. Great, that's okay. Again, that's the Buddha's recognition. It's okay to enjoy this life. It's the middle way. It's okay to wish for our friends that they have even more love in their life, that they're even more popular or whatever, you know, that they're even more something or other. But at the same time, to feel loved enough, to feel liked enough already, so that, again, there doesn't need to be a basis for that deficit or disturbance around relationships. Or you can play around with this too, a sense of feeling radically connected to everything already. Already, you know, connected to other people, all the people, life you've had, humanity altogether, the natural world, if it works for you. Find what works for you. Works for me. To recognize, wow, I'm already totally connected. Why am I scratching and clawing for more connection? You know? Anyway, so finishing up here. The subtlety, and this goes, by the way, to the third foundation of mindfulness in Buddhist practice, because it's essentially, the Buddha in his own way is essentially talking about what I'm talking here. This ongoing recognition, huh, what's the mind of craving? What's the mind of not craving? What's the mind of deficit? What's the mind of enoughness? Oh. What's the mind of disturbance? Including subtle edginess or rattledness, right? And what's the mind of balance, of equanimity? And practice, I think truly, is to become more and more kind of moment to moment and fine-tuned in your awareness of that difference, and to gradually wake up from what is usually a delusion that there's not enough or we're disturbed, when in fact we're actually almost always really all right. We're almost always, if not always, in some deep sense, entirely satisfied already with all that's come to us already. And we're definitely always connected profoundly. And I think most people really have been loved enough. They can find an authentic place inside where, you know, I really can truly feel I've been loved and liked enough. Be nice to have more. And I can feel a kind of resting in the heart. I've been loved enough. Anyway, so tracking that distinction, and when you're having those little moments of third noble truthness, right? Fullness, rather, you know, fullness, balance, grounding, and no basis for grasping, no basis for resisting, no basis for clinging. Really let it sink in. So more and more, you just kind of hang in there. And that's where you come from. You know, as you engage life and deal with challenges to safety, losses around satisfaction, or rejections around connection. And that's what I want to invite you into as an ongoing practice, to find that place where you can feel, in three words, peace, contentment, and love. So, what do you make of all that? Three refuges. Yeah, great.
I can't help but think of the movie Awake, which is about Yogananda's life. And in one place, this man came in front of him and said, "But what do you think about when we want to eat too much? What about, I mean, what do you think is bad and what do you think is good? You know, is it okay to smoke too much? Is it okay to go after girls too much? Is that okay?" And Yogananda said, "Yes," to everything he mentioned. He said, "Yes. But if you keep listening to what I have to say and meditate, you won't want to."
Yeah, great. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Great movie.
Thank you. And I know for myself, like, just to use your example, so you can tell the difference. There you are, and you're sitting down, and there's the plate of cookies, right? Or whatever it might be. And, you know, then you can feel in yourself, because it's natural to crave. It's very biological. You can feel this, like, oh, yeah. And the trick is also to really establish yourself more and more in a stability of "and also." So that in the moment, yes, there is that, want that cookie, whatever. Want to make that point. I want to be right. I want to take care of that email, you know, or something like that, right? And then, and also, I'm really okay already. I don't need to win this point. I'm already entirely satisfied. I don't really need that second or third or fifth cookie. You know, that to me is exploration. And a lot of that natural, automatic drive, because craving is a drive state. It's interesting how many of the great psychologies have been about drives. Buddhism as well. The Four Noble Truths are totally psychological. Totally psychological. Right? And I don't know about you, but when I look closely at an awful lot of those drives, they're grounded in deficit and disturbance. Usually, that's not actually true. That's part of what's crazy about it. It's like delusional craving. You know, so again, just take a look. You look at it, you go, wow. And then if we are mindful enough in the moment to go, you know, there's some kind of bogus deficit or disturbance behind this oomph here. Do I really need to act that out? Or can I gradually disentangle myself from it and gradually, you know, rest and take my stand more and more and more? It's kind of like shifting your weight, you know? Craving? Not craving. Second noble truth? Third noble truth. And there's kind of a... you know, and as you root more and more in third noble truth, not craving, then the inclination to crave just gets less and less. It's less and less reinforced. This really shows up in relationships, you know. Yeah. Okay. What else? What do you think? Great.
I just wanted to go to a little tiny corner of what you touched on, and perhaps just offer some thought about that.
Yeah.
You know, I think I've got decades of practice of managing cravings and desires and in ways that result in being reasonably productive in the kind of culture we live in. Mm. And it's interesting to think about what it would be like not to have those cravings and those desires and that grasping and still trying to be productive in the kind of culture we've got, and whether there are really, whether there's any research.
Well, I was going to ask you, it's right, so my summary phrase for that is aspiration without attachment, right? Yeah, so how about, what have you found? You've been investigating this. Like, what's it feel like when you're aiming high without any background sense of deficit or disturbance?
I think what's difficult is to know the difference between being in a state of non-attachment or being in a state of flatness or, you know, kind of depression or whatever.
Yeah.
That we don't have, I don't personally have a whole lot of experience understanding the difference between those things. I have a lot of experience with the dry state.
Yeah.
And not with the difference between being flat versus being non-attached and not grasping.
I know, I find this really more than anything, I so appreciate what you're both saying here. It's an exploration, you know? And it's really interesting to explore what is it like to seek to get things done. Dishes are dirty. You know, somebody's got to do them. You go to sleep, there's going to be there in the sink in the morning, right? And so the thing is, oh, okay, here's the task, right? Or, you know, you've got to write something. Maybe it's a complex task. How do you do that? Or maybe you're trying to get something done with another person, like get something done with a kid who's sort of resisting you, or in a relationship. How do you do that while sustaining the experience and regenerating the experience of feeling already entirely satisfied? Right? I'm doing this dish already entirely satisfied. Like, what's that like, right? What's it like to eat? I'm already satisfied. There's already enough. It's a great exploration.
I've been working with the question whether having a Buddhist practice means diminishment of feelings. And I think to some extent, it does. I'm not putting any valence on that. For example, you know, tomorrow's Thanksgiving, and on about 5 o'clock, there's a real big football game coming on. And,
that's right.
Which I would like to see live. But I know nobody in this crowd probably is going to be a football fan.
You talking about this group?
No.
Or the people you're having Thanksgiving with? What?
And what I try to do, I would like to see the game. But
yeah.
I try to think it forward. And put myself in the situation and then imagine different scenarios. And in this case, I was thinking this afternoon, I said, well, you know, if I can't watch that game live, maybe I'll actually end up talking to somebody new who's very engaging. Or, heaven forbid, a business prospect. And so that's what I try to do, but and I also realize I just don't care. On one level I do care if I could see that game. But on another level, and I think it's from practice, I don't care. You know? I'm just
that's
taking
right.
And it kind of fits in to what Will probably was saying 2 weeks ago. Of being grateful for everything, because you don't know, one does not know the surprise that might be in the pile in the barnyard. And so anyway, I just like to comment on that, but sometimes I feel like I'm losing my ability to have feelings, and I don't have any feelings about that. I mean, I don't know.
No, that's great. Thank you.
So what's the answer?
Well, I think the answer, first and foremost, well, I'm going to come at it two ways. So I sent out, I don't know if you get my Just One Thing newsletter, but you'll see in it, it'll probably show up in your inbox tonight or early tomorrow morning, there's this link to this story about the Dalai Lama going to a ski resort and talking to a waitress who asked him, what is the meaning of life? And it's a beautiful piece. It's a funny piece. And it won't take anything away from the story for me to tell you what his response was. Okay. And so a way into that was that essentially all these things happen. It's quite funny. It's in the 80s where Dalai Lama wasn't the Dalai Lama then, you know. And he was just kind of bumming rides and hanging out, and it was very informal. Anyway, long story short, this waitress asked him, you know, what is the meaning of life? And he was at a meal at a ski resort. And everybody else fell silent because that was the one question they wanted to ask but had been too embarrassed to ask. And he said, well, the answer to that question is obvious. The meaning of life is happiness, the point. Happiness broadly defined, particularly obviously the deep, third noble truth kind of happiness we're talking about. He said, but the really interesting question is not what is the meaning of life. Everybody knows the answer to that. It's happiness, right? The real deep question is, how do you find that deep happiness? Do you find it through piling up possessions, through beating other people out, or through cultivating wisdom and love in your own heart? That's really the important question. So I think my first take about it is that what's important is to gauge the consideration. What is it that brings lasting happiness? Is it to get rigid and righteous and entitled about seeing the 49ers and Seahawks live, no matter what anybody else wants? God darn it, I'm going to sit here and claim my sofa. The rest of you can just do your thing. I'm giving thanks for my remote control. Whatever, you know what I mean? Well, maybe not. You know, maybe, you know, happiness is found through other means, which takes me then to this quote that just was present when you were talking there, you know. I forget the source. I think it's a prayer in Christianity. Lord, teach me to care and not to care. Teach me to care and not to care. Two meanings there, right? And I think that's why I'm hearing what you're saying, you know. Teach me to care about these sorts of things and not to care about those sorts of things, in a nutshell. And the thing that I believe is really true, from a super hardcore just evolutionary neurology, is that we're designed to be deluded most of the time around imaginary threats, losses, and rejections, safety, satisfaction, connection, and agitated about them. And to be deluded continually and not see the fullness and the balance that's already there. Right? And so it's really quite a radical act to again and again and again and again kind of wake up from that spell and rest in, oh, fullness, enoughness, balance, and then find out how to be in life on the basis of that. For me, I don't know, this has become a really cool practice. Because also it's a very happy one. You know what I mean? What's your practice? Oh, my practice is to wake up from the dream and to hang out in peace, contentment, and love. And in the process, be less and less of a dickhead. all right. not too bad. All right, yeah.
Oh, no, I love what you said, because I haven't thought about it exactly that. It reminds me of a book I read in college, Yalom's book, Love's Executioner.
Uh-huh.
And it was about how we're all infatuated with love, and if you're a psychologist, you're often bursting someone's bubble to show them reality. And so you have to be love's executioner. And I do feel like in some ways it's taken me getting used to the mindfulness of, I don't get as infatuated. The flame doesn't go as high. Mm-hmm. And the fantasies aren't as big because I don't buy that this thing is going to save me and really I'm going to be nothing without it. So it's not as high and low. I mean, the flame never went as deep. It didn't sort of permeate my whole being the way I feel like happiness does now. But it did get some taking getting used to. Like in the beginning, I was a little like, oh, it's not going to be quite so, you know, such a pop. So it's interesting. It's really.
That's great. Yeah. Maybe I'll end on this little story of kind of a primary teacher of mine, Christina Feldman. And an area where we often can get subtly disturbed is we want something to happen over there. We want us to like us a certain thing. We want them to buy our book. We want them to think certain things about us, right? Okay. And so I taught a workshop at Spirit Rock with Christina. Christina's an English woman, did a lot of practice in Asia as a young woman, and I find her to be very much like a kind of deeply developed monastic living the life of a single mother, you know, in the middle of England, and Christina. So, and she has that kind of English, just cut through, no nonsense, kawoosh. Okay. So I was teaching with her and at Spirit Rock, and what I noticed was that she cared, but she didn't care. She cared to make her point and to try to say it skillfully and to do little things as a teacher, a little joke here, a little, all right, let's take a break there, you know. She cared to be skillful. She wasn't phoning in her performance. She wasn't at all in a state of apathy. That's what's so interesting, is to be engaged in this way. And at the same time, in a way that wasn't true for me, especially, you know, especially then more as like a particularly a beginning teacher, she didn't care what people learned, got, thought. And that was weird. Like, really? You're like, there are 150 people in this room, you know, you're teaching this, you're offering this precious dharma through yourself, you're a vehicle for it. You literally don't care if they get anything from what you say? Yeah. And I got that she was in a real state of equanimity. It wasn't indifference, it wasn't unkindness. Individually, she was very, very kind to people. She'd work hard, but she really got it that she just couldn't control what people got. She didn't have any kind of, unlike me, she didn't have any personal internal sense of deficit or need for approval. She didn't need them to get anything. And because she didn't need the people in the room to get anything, they got everything. They got a ton. You see what I'm saying? And that's something also you might explore and play around with. What if you are with other people, or, you know, we want certain reactions from other people, and what's it like to keep regenerating again and again? I'm okay with you, even if you don't give me that reaction I want, right? Like, I'm not disturbed over here by what's happening over there for you. I love you. I like you. I wish you well. I really would like to help. And I'm not disturbed over here by what happens about that over there. It's a weird place. It's like, how do we find that, right? It's very loving. It's very caring. Teach me to care. And also, don't care. Not disturbed in my core about what's going on over there in response to me. Yeah, please.
Well, like,
and then we'll wrap up. Yeah.
That has everything to me to do with not needing to be validated from the outside.
Yeah.
And when I got that, I mean, it's such a freedom to be authentic. And that's what it was, a process of me learning to be authentic, to appreciate that, and to really, it's a gift to allow someone to have their own experience. Whatever it is.
Yeah.
And not be attached to it.
Boy.
Not attachment is to me what you're talking about. Caring but not attached.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for saying that. That you zapped me there. Thank you. That's great. Okay, how about we kind of sit in the zap zone for the last minute here? Let that establishing occur. You know, undisturbed.